Hello, and welcome to part two of the inaugural episode of Weekly Monotony, the official podcast of the entertainment blog DailyMonotony.com, where the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and none of the kids play Halo 3 on Xbox Live. So, our last episode was a little bit long, so we had to split it in twain, as it were, and we now present to you the second half of the inaugural episode, perhaps episode 1B, which is, of course, my top 10 movies, and a little bit of fun discussion at the end. Hope you enjoy. Let's go ahead and move on to my top 10 list. There's a lot of crossovers, so hopefully this one should actually go a bit faster, but I'm actually going to start from the bottom, so from number 10, and work my way up to number 1. So my number 10 pick, this was a very hard thing to go. I actually have 5 or 6 movies all sort of vying for this spot. The one that eventually won out the spot was Martin McDonagh's In Bruges. As we've talked about, this is a great film, a movie that I definitely loved and enjoyed seeing, even if it's not going to be something I purchase and watch all the time. I feel it's hard not to acknowledge this movie in some way as being just one of the great sort of, out of left field films coming this year.
It's not the movie you watch with your significant other while you cuddle in your pajamas.
Definitely not. I think I can agree to that. But I think we've probably done this one about as much as we can say, so I don't think there's much more we can say about that. So I'll move on to my number 9, which is one we haven't talked about yet, which was Frost Nixon.
You had a pleasant evening last night?
Yes. 4, 3, 2.
Did you do any fornicating?
And Hugh David.
The American people need a conviction. I'd like to give Richard Nixon the trial he never had. Democracy depends on it.
We're not going to let that happen. We're going to make him choke on power and glory.
Why didn't you burn the tapes?
I didn't want to take any questions on Watergate.
Shut it down.
I will ruin you if it takes the rest of my life.
What have I done?
If in this interview Nixon exonerates himself,
4,
that would be the worst crime of all.
3, 2, Hugh David.
Are you really saying the president can do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry.
It's Frost Nixon, a Ron Howard movie starring Frank Langella, Michael Sheen, based on a stage play by the same guy who wrote the stage play and I believe directed the movie The Queen.
That's correct.
So, this is one of these movies that I think has sort of dropped down in the order. Like I think this, if I made this list the day after I saw this movie, it would have been a lot higher. It's really all about the character performances, and I'd say to some degree all about Frank Langella's performance of Richard Nixon, which is really stupendous. It's something, I think it takes a character who is, a very sort of tortured character in his life at this period, having coming right off resigning from the presidency and going through the whole Watergate scandal and now, being questioned by this. And there's so much subtlety put into the performance of this character who's both, wily and trying to prevent himself from, being forced to open up and talk about what he actually did and his actual role in the Watergate stuff. And yet there's also this side to him that gets revealed in several scenes in very subtle ways where he's almost, asking the character of David Frost to beat the truth out of him or to beat a confession out of him. But not in a way that he says, I'm going to come out and say this. He constantly reminds the character of David Frost that, he's going to bring his best and he's going to, go at it, no holds barred. And yet there's like this moment where he drunk dials David Frost and he has this, this wonderful scene where he basically talks about, how growing up he felt like he was looked down upon by others and how he's trying to, get back on the top, and this is sort of tragicness to the character, and could not be performed better by Frank Langella. Unfortunately, I don't think he's going to win an Oscar for this role, as I think Mickey Rourke has probably got that one placed out for The Wrestler, but still a great movie. If if you're into history films, if you liked movies like 13 Days, which is about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is one of my favorite movies, you'll love this movie. I think it's gotten some mixed reviews around. I know my brother, who's definitely not as into sort of artsy films or plays, kind of found it a little slow, although enjoyable. But no, I think this is something that you definitely should see, and I think deserves to be on a top ranking somewhere in your list, even if not the top 10.
Yeah, it was certainly one of my runners up. I liked the film a lot. I thought it was good. It is powered entirely by Frank Langella's performance as Nixon. It didn't quite have the vitality that I was looking for, the sort of, you know, innovation, if you will, you know, greatest new achievement in film, so to speak, to get on the top 10 list. But it's certainly one of my honorable mentions. Michael Sheen, who plays David Frost, I'm a huge fan of his performance from The Queen. The writing for his character was a little bit flat as it comes across in the stage play.
Agreed.
You know, that may be an accurate depiction of reality, but left me wanting a little bit more from him. And ditto for the rest of the supporting cast. You know, it was all sort of laid out very conventionally, very commercially. There were no big surprises on that end. So it really is centered around Nixon and Langella's performance as the former president.
And one of the criticisms I could easily throw out this is that there's several sequences where they have like these like documentary style flashbacks where they're talking to, you know, a character, you know, an actor as the character from the future about what happened, and it was so sporadic that I really question, you know, like, you know, whether this was just, you know, Ron Howard not being, you know, being a good director but not necessarily, you know, a great director in this sense of just throwing in these, you know, weird sequences that I think really pulled you out of what the crux of the story was, which were these, you know, these interviews between David Frost and Richard Nixon.
It's obviously a meta reference and allusion to Atonement.
To some degree, yeah. But anyway,
that was a joke, by the way.
Either way, a good movie, definitely a great film, and my number 9 pick. So moving on, my number 8 is Garth Jennings' Son of Rambo. You know, hearing, you know, Scott talk about it more now, like, I sort of wish this had gotten a little higher up there, but definitely I think it is, you know, something that just
my
hasn't...
glowing praise is elevated.
Well, it's something that's just sort of been out of my focus for a while, which I feel is sort of a problem with the Academy, is a lot of the movies that, you know, tend to make it into that list are stuff that came out recently because you're thinking about them recently. Whereas this was a great film that came out, you know, over the summer and, you know, is very easy to forget about, but still such a great movie, such a heartwarming movie. And this is a movie I could easily see myself watching over and over again just because it's, you know, it's fun. It'll, you know, pick you up on a bad day. And that's what entertainment is supposed to do. It's supposed to, you know, like, entertain you and sort of provide some sort of, you know, goodness in your life. So
so what you're saying is you're not going to go out and campaign for My Bloody Valentine 3D.
Probably not. Probably not too hard.
Just a little.
But yeah, I think we've said about as much as we can on that. So I'll move on to my number 7, which has not been mentioned, which was Iron Man.
Mr. Stark, Christine Everhart, Vanity Fair magazine. Can I ask you a couple of questions?
She's cute. She's all right. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah.
It's okay?
Okay, go.
You've been called the Da Vinci of our time. What do you say to that?
Absolutely ridiculous. I don't paint.
And what do you say to your other nickname, the Merchant of Death?
That's not bad. Let me guess. Berkeley?
Brown, actually.
Well, Ms. Brown... It's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start making bricks and beams for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
Every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
I can see that.
I'd like to show you firsthand.
Ah, something I've seen.
Very well.
great. So, this was a total surprise of a movie for me. So, I'm not a huge fan of comic book movies. I've definitely liked my fair share of them. I thought... The first Spider-Man movie was great. You know, definitely, you know, The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, great movies. Thought Spider-Man 2 was terrible. Spider-Man 3 was ridiculous. Didn't see the Hulk remake. Was not really expecting much out of this. But just one of those, like, you know, this was like one of the first blockbusters of the summer. And I think just set the tone and this, you know, set a huge bar for the sort of summer blockbuster movies. by this amazing performance by Robert Downey Jr., who just fit this role of this, you know, 40-year-old or plus Tony Stark, who's this, you know, this arrogant, rich, you know, wealthy guy who, you know, ends up playing this you know, sort of semi-arrogant superhero, but just absolutely stunning. And also the way that he can just, that Robert Downey Jr. is able to just sort of move himself from these quirky, arrogant roles to something that, you know, like edges on being, you know, human, and actually I think does a great job of getting some of the more subtlety of the character behind the sort of facade that he puts on, which I think only Robert Downey Jr. can do in a very great way. But a really, really great movie. Scott, thoughts?
I'm sorry, what are we talking about? That's a joke. This was a good movie. This was very enjoyable. You know, it works as an actioneer, and to some extent it works as a character piece. As long as Robert Downey Jr. is on screen, I'm interested. As soon as that's not the case, it starts to feel a little bit commercial, a little bit calculated for me. Oh, sure. There's a bad guy who I've known all along, you know.
Sure.
Oh, there's a final boss fight, you know. There's terrorists. Those are bad guys, right? But, oh, I'm fighting the Air Force for a while. But it's okay, because I'll make some funny jokes and I'll be on the phone.
Sure.
You could list the cliches the movie uses, and it would be a long list. It's not bad in that regard. It's not so commercial that I'm willing to reject it completely. But I'm not quite willing to embrace it as fully as some people have. I think it's entertaining. It helped tide me over until Tropic Thunder, but it did not really settle in my mind as being one of the great entries in the genre of action franchise.
Sure. Sean, this is finally one of the movies that you saw, so let's hear your thoughts on it.
Well, the thing I like about it, first of all, is that Iron Man sort of bucks comic book trends. There's a rule in comic books that if you're a superhero, your identity, your real identity has to be a secret.
Oh, right.
And of course, Iron Man, now this is, you know, part of comic book canon that this is so, but even so, that he just outright throws that out there is cool. And the way, like you were saying, that Robert Downey Jr. plays this arrogant, slightly bombastic character is really perfect, and that outcome of his becoming a superhero doesn't leave you wondering at all. It's one of those things that just seems to fit.
Right.
If you will. He manages to fit into the role very, very nicely. And at the same time, you don't get the impression that he's a shallow character at all.
Right.
That just really, not just in challenging what the comic book rules of engagement, so to speak, were, challenges sort of what the comic book movie rules are. And so I definitely think it deserves a mention among the top movies of the year.
And I totally think, like, I know they're building this up to do the Avengers, which is a sort of combined superhero plot between several of these superheroes, including the Incredible Hulk and I think Thor and some other characters.
Right.
And if it were not, I think for this movie being sort of the springboard for that project, there's no way I would go and see an Avengers movie, just because it sounds ridiculous and sounds like it would be terrible. But the fact
you make Paramount very sad.
Right. And the fact that Iron Man was just such a great way and such a fresh start to the summer, especially, has totally sold me into this series, which makes me sad that I haven't seen the remake for the Hulk, because that is part of what's going to be moving into the series. But hopefully that's going to be a great thing to go from.
Primarily because it did have a little bit of a cameo from Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man character.
Yeah, I heard that, right.
But it's like a single line. It really is not representative of what he can do with the character.
Right.
But anyway, it was okay. It was good. It was a fun movie. Not nearly what you would get out of going to see Iron Man.
Sure.
But a very capable movie in its own right, and far, far above
the Ang Lee,
Hulk, the Ang Lee
Ang. Crazy, terrible
version. I think that was something that was lost in translation there. What company is this? Sony that owns all this stuff, owns
Paramount.
The rights to these.
Yeah, this is Paramount that's doing these, I believe.
Okay, because I thought Sony was behind the Spider-Man stuff.
They do own, yeah, they do. The Marvel company, I think, chooses sort of to work around with who it wants, and it has done a lot of stuff with Sony recently. But I think, Was the X-Men movies Sony? I don't remember.
I'm not sure which production company did Hulk with Ang Lee, but just like I said, it seems like something was lost in translation there. Somebody at some company is like, "Oh, we're going to make Hulk. Who we get? Oh, Hulk, get Ang Lee."
He's a great director, right? He's done a bunch of weird art house crap.
Universal Pictures, right there.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Now it makes sense.
Hey, at least they marketed it well.
Anyway, Iron Man, definitely a great movie. A movie I own on Blu-ray now. Something that's just feels fun to watch, and an enjoyable movie from, I think, beginning to end. All right, so let's move on to my number six choice. Also something that was not mentioned on Scott's list, which is The Wrestler.
One, two, wham!
Really good. You really brought it.
Thank you.
You hang in there. You got a lot of ability.
Have you ever seen a one-trick pony and feel so happy and free?
I was wondering if I could get some more work.
All I got is weekends. Isn't that when you sit on other dudes' faces?
Have you ever seen a one-legged dog?
You have a beer with me? One beer.
You have a daughter?
Oh, my daughter. She don't like me very much.
You should call her.
Any you seen me?
What do you want from me?
I'm an old, broken-down piece of meat, and I deserve to be all alone. I just don't want you to hate me.
So this is Darren Aronofsky. And in case you don't know, Darren Aronofsky also did the movie The Fountain, which was that crazy Rachel Weisz, Hugh Jackman sci-fi movie. He's also famous for doing Requiem for a Dream and Pi, which are both really weird, out there kind of movies. And, you know, his entry into this is, or his next entry, and a really wonderful entry too, is The Wrestler, which is this almost documentary style, cinema verite style movie of starring Mickey Rourke playing this sort of, you know, aged wrestler on sort of his kind of last legs in his profession, but, you know, was once, you know, a tremendous thing, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, and now sort of dealing with this, you know, life after glory thing, this sort of, you know, the, you know, as he calls it, you know, an old piece of, you know, old piece of meat who's sort of broken down. What really grabbed me about this film is it's so incredibly genuine in every way. The filmmaking style is very genuine. They don't try to do anything crazy. It's, and a lot of it's this like over the shoulder third person camera shot of just like following the Mickey Rourke's character around as he walks, you know, away from his car, or walks, you know, through his part time job at a grocery store. And the performances by Mickey Rourke's character, I mean, like, if you didn't know that this was an actor, you'd think that they found this actual character, this actual wrestling character, and we're just following his life story. Like, I don't know how Mickey Rourke does this, but he embodies it so incredibly well. And I think, to some degree, because there's a lot of his own personal story in here. Mickey Rourke, an actor who actually went off and tried to be a professional boxer for a while, and then, you know, he got his face messed up in a fight and had to quit that and sort of give up on his dream. So I think there's a lot of real human emotion being put into this role, which is why it, you know, grabbed the best actor at the Golden Globes and almost certainly will do it for the Oscars.
I couldn't be any more excited about The Wrestler. I haven't been able to catch it yet because it is not out in the Houston area as far as I can tell at the moment. But I'll preemptively say it's amazing, and get back to you if I have to change my position.
Yeah, and like, you know, I'm not someone who, you know, who cries a lot or likes crying movies, but I was bawling during this movie. But in a good way. It's such a, I don't know, it feels like such a fresh movie. And even though it's only number 6 on my list, and probably some of the other stuff above this, you'll disagree that they shouldn't be there, but I think this is one of those movies that's sort of been like percolating up in my list. In fact, this has actually changed places several times, and I think eventually will become a, as I dwell on it more, a even more liked movie, but such a good movie. Definitely something you should see as it sort of reaches its peak of wide release, probably pretty soon. Sean, have you been aware of this movie? Like, is this one of those things where you thought you've seen previews for it, or is it? I'm sorry, I missed it. What?
I said this was not even on my radar.
And that's so unfortunate, because it's such a good movie, and I think actually has a lot of good broad appeal. I think a lot of people would like this, but I mean, come on, like, you know, what needs to be done to get these great movies out there? Hopefully that's what we're doing, and hopefully that's what, you know, the word of mouth can do, but. Definitely see it once you guys get in your theater. Okay, my number 5 pick is probably going to be the most controversial pick on this list, but I stand by it quite firmly.
I love controversy.
My number 5 pick is the Wachowski brothers' Speed Racer.
This ain't no dead piece of metal. The car's a living, breathing thing, and she's alive. Speed. You can feel her talking to you. Telling you what she wants, what she needs. All you gotta do is listen. Close your eyes and listen. Like I said, Ben Burns drove the final lap of the Vanderbilt Cup with his eyes closed.
No way!
No? Maybe you just can't hear it then. Maybe you ought to start hitting those books.
No, I hear it!
Oh, is that so, Mr. Burns? Alright, tell me when to punch you for the jump. Now?
Okay, so I'm going to take flack. I'm going to take a ton of flack for this, but that's okay.
You put Speed Racer above Son of Rambo.
Above Son of Rambo, above The Wrestler. Again, I know this is controversial, but I'll stand by this and hopefully explain myself. So this was one of those movies that, you know, when it came out, critics just tore this thing to shreds and, you know, called it like cotton candy and a bunch of other fun, you know, critical nasty things. And you know, I was looking at I like the Wachowski brothers in general. I really like their sort of vision and their film style. And so, and we had a digital, you know, pure digital theater in College Station. And I was like, well, I'm gonna go see this. It's in digital. It looks really cool. And maybe it was just like the time. There's a dearth of good movies at the time, but. Like, when I sat there sawing this, and there's actually, you know, a couple other, you know, like, younger, you know, kids in the room. I was probably, like, the only like, not child or not mom in the theater at the time. But something about this just reminded me why I love cartoons and why I love, like, bright, colorful, shiny stuff and, like, thin story plots that are just happy in the end. Like this movie, like, made me tear up when, like, Speed Racer was winning races, and I don't know what it was, but I absolutely love this movie. And it's, you know, it's clearly has its flaws. There's some really bad acting in it. There's a lot of really shallow plots in it, but absolutely stunningly gorgeous movie. The most colorful movie, and, you know, purposely done that way. There's a lot of work done to make things hyper real and hyper stylized and oversaturated. But in that way that I think the Wachowskis have come closest to making a live action movie into a cartoon than anyone else has tried, and I really think this sets the bar for it, and unfortunately, I don't think anyone else is going to look at this because it got so trash in the box office and by critics. But to me, just a wonderful movie, a fresh take on cartoons, really really fun. And I don't know, I will stand by this as my number 5 movie of the year. Something I bought on Blu-ray, something I will watch over and over again. I'm not sure if any of you guys have seen it, but I'll let you now comment on my. My very controversial choice.
Well, I haven't seen it, but I'll quote some of my friends at Sony Computer Entertainment when I say, it's Speed Racer! Speed Racer!
Yes, indeed. Yes,
indeed. That's really all I'm afraid I'm able to add. But yeah, it's got Matthew Fox in it, and he's on Lost, and that's back next week, so I guess I can get behind that, right?
Sean, I take it you probably did not see this movie as well?
Did not see this movie. I'm not a huge movie goer.
Right.
And this seemed like more of a commercial cash in than anything else.
I think it sort of got some of that, you know, in like the way it was advertised and the fact that it was coming out during all these other big summer blockbusters. But I don't know. I really think they did something special and unique with this movie. Like a lot of the technical side of it. Like they did a lot of stuff where they took, you know, still pictures of stuff, and they did this sort of a layering of the backgrounds as being kind of, you know, like still pictures with a parallaxing. So like they would they take a bunch of, you know, like of just like 2D stills and do like this sort of, you know, like 2D parallax stuff that just sort of brought out this sort of anime cartoon feel to it. Stuff to me that felt very adventurous for a movie, you know, where they could have just, you know, gone out and done CG backgrounds and made this everything feel like it was, you know, real in CG, but they decided not to do that. They decided to make it completely cartoonish, which to me I think was a very dangerous choice, and obviously one they failed, unfortunately, in the box office, but I think so unique compared to any other movie that I've seen. And I think really worth seeing, you know, if you love cartoons at all, if you love anime at all, I think you would like this movie. I might be wrong, as, you know, the box office and critics has told me, but definitely one of my favorite movies of the year, hands down.
Don't let the critical notice stop you.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because there's movies like that I've seen in the past that were just slammed by critics everywhere, but I enjoyed them. One of them that I'd like to bring up was the Godzilla movie. With John Leguizamo.
Right.
Loved the movie. Fantastic monster movie. No, it wasn't Godzilla. but all of those who are you know, just loyal to the Godzilla canon are going to hate me for this, but I thought it was better, in fact.
I've seen some classic Godzilla movies, and I'll admit, I enjoyed the new Godzilla movie far more than I enjoy any of the classic Godzilla movies.
yes. So, yeah. It's a shame it never went anywhere, and it got so much bad reviewage.
Right, which I think an unfortunate thing of sort of like the print press critics, is I feel like there's a lot of, like, while they do call out a lot of good films, they also really, you know, dish on some really remarkable films that, you know, if you're able to, you know, take off, you know, that sort of, you know, stuck up critical hat and just like enjoy film as entertainment, which I feel like a lot of critics have lost in some degree, or at least there's I've had that perception, if that's, you know, even if it's not true.
The idea, I think, behind their criticism is they want to drive the art form forward.
Sure.
You know, bashing games that are the same is very common in current game reviews, and I think it's been fairly common in movie reviews for quite a while. Is, you know, bash this movie because it hasn't done anything new. But I don't know. I think sometimes there's room for recycling, because obviously, if we didn't have that, we'd have a lot fewer movies.
Sure. And it's actually kind of interesting. I was watching Ratatouille just like the other week. It was on the TV, and the speech at the end by Ego, the food critic, where he gives this speech about what it means to be a critic, and I think it's actually very thought-provoking. And one of the things he says is, you know, when a critic really lays down, like, you know, their credibility is in the defense of the new. Which I feel like there's so much groupthink, I think, amongst the critical crowd, that, Like, there really is little of that going on. I feel like that actually Ratatouille is almost a statement in some degrees on that concept, is that, you know, don't just sit in this, you know, groupthink thing. You know, sometimes you need to go out there and, like, try, you know, like, calling out something is good, even if everyone else thinks it's bad. Just, you know, bring something new into what we've got. And that's what hopefully I feel like I'm doing with Speed Racer. Watch the movie and, you know, agree or disagree. But that's, yeah, that's my defense of the new for this year. But anyway, I think
consider
that's...
Consider it so defended.
Well, let's move on to my number four pick, which we talked to death already, but gotta mention it, was Slumdog Millionaire. Danny Boyle, such a great job. See this movie. I guarantee you this movie will be out in March when it gets nominated or wins an Oscar. So you'll have a chance to see this in theaters. Definitely go see it in a packed theater with other people. I think you will enjoy it immensely more. But I think we've probably talked this one to death. So I will move on to my number three pick, which we have not talked about, which is Doubt.
Frosty the Snowman espouses a pagan belief in magic. The snowman comes to life when an enchanted hat is put on his head. If the music were more somber, people would realize the images are disturbing and the song heretical.
I never thought about Frosty the Snowman like that.
Should be banned from the airwaves.
So, not Frosty the Snowman.
Oh, it's beginning to look like a lot like Christmas. It'd be fine, I suppose. Parents would like it. May I ask what you're writing down? Is that ballpoint pen?
Oh, nothing. It's an idea for a sermon.
You had one right now?
I get them all the time.
Unfortunate.
I forget them, so I have to write them down.
Oh. What is the idea?
Intolerance.
So Doubt, a movie and a play written and directed by John Patrick Shanley, which is really weird. John Patrick Shanley, the only, like, some of the other big things he's noted for are, like, the Joe versus the Volcano movie with Tom Hanks way back in the 80s, and I think he wrote the script for Congo, which was an adapted script from a Michael Crichton book, and then he writes a play and directs a movie about that play, which is about as opposite of those two movies previously mentioned as you could possibly get, and is absolutely, like, I don't know, it's this one of my favorite movies of this year. Totally, you know, it was very affecting to me. I thought incredibly thought-provoking, and we actually, after seeing this movie, you guys would remember, we actually came back and we had, you know, a good, you know, hour-long debate and conversation about the implications of this into religion and how a religion relates to, or how, you know, the concept of, you know, secrecy in the confession relates to the organization of religion. And to me, any movie that can, you know...
The 4 liters of beer didn't hurt anyone either.
That did not hurt, bringing out the conversation. That's definitely true. But stupendous performance. Huge, huge power hitters in here. Philip Seymour Hoffman, who can do no wrong in my opinion. He everything he does in is absolutely wonderful. I think he's a shining example of an actor who takes each of his roles very seriously. I don't know. He's a powerhouse in this. Both when he's giving these sort of sermons from the pulpit, which are, you know, hugely affecting, and then also this sort of lighter side of himself, and this kind of, you know, darker, questionable side that the movie sort of brings out. It's a really, really tremendous performance by him. How he did not get nominated, or did he get nominated for Golden Globes? I don't think he was.
That would require me to tell you something.
I'm pretty sure he did not. I don't remember seeing his. I don't think he's going to get nominated for an Oscar, which is... I just don't understand that. I thought it was a tremendous performance. And then also Meryl Streep, good grief. I had completely written Meryl Streep off, like, you know, because she's in movies like Mamma Mia and, like, all these other really terrible roles. And I think I saw Meryl Streep in the Prairie Home Companion.
Devil Wears Prada.
Or in the Prairie Home Companion movie, and she was, like, ridiculously terrible. And I know I got to the point where I just could not stand Meryl Streep. But in this movie, good grief, she is amazing. Has one of the truest and best New York accents I think I've ever seen a character do. plays walking this line of, you know, being a very stereotypical character of this kind of mean headmistress of this Catholic school, to having, you know, true compassion and true worry, to, you know, bearing on the edge of being obsessive and perhaps, you know, even herself wondering if what she's doing is tearing apart, you know, this institution of this Catholic school. Incredibly well acted. I don't know how. Well, again, I have not seen the role that beat out Meryl Streep, which was Kate Winslet in the Golden Globes. But good grief, her role in Revolutionary Road must be fantastic to beat out Meryl Streep. Amy Adams is also in this movie. I didn't think she was incredible in it. I felt she sort of did a very similar role to what she other kind of does in other movies. But just seeing
but
this
remains Amy Adams and is still therefore spectacular.
Exactly. But yeah, just for seeing two great performances by Philip Seymour Hoffman and Meryl Streep, definitely one of my favorite movies. Scott, I'm sure you have very differing opinions, so I'll let you take that.
That's true. This was on the list of quote good movies when I was trying to decide what my top 10 list was in, and on some consideration, it got demoted to runners up and then demoted out of that group subsequently as well. I don't think there's anything untrue about what Dustin has said. The sub cinema, so to speak, in this film, I think, is what ultimately left me sort of feeling uneasy. The film is perfectly titled Doubt. It is a recognition of doubt. It is a salute to agnosticism in all of its forms. Anything you think you could have doubts about it in this movie would like to remind you that you could do that, and maybe it's not even a bad idea to do that sometimes, says the film. You know, I don't have anything against agnosticism as a general first principle, but it's not one that I would particularly hold to, and so at the end of the day, it leaves me with a certain sort of thematic distaste for the film, which is what ultimately overrode the fact that I really did like a lot of the technical and artistic aspects that were on display here.
Yeah, one of the other things that I really liked about the sort of way this movie was shot is it used a lot of things that I think are called Dutch angles, which are basically where you take the camera and you sort of tilt it off from being level. And so many of the scenes were just like completely askew, like, you know, someone walking through the hallway and like you're seeing this camera, you know, that's like, you know, tilted 30 degrees to the left. Almost every shot, like, or I don't say every shot, but there were a ton of shots like that. And to me, I just love that way that added this kind of, you know, this weird, almost, you know, like, you know, funhouse effect to the movie, which, you know, a lot of the stuff that was going on, you know, with these characters was in many ways was, you know, very, very, you know, twisting in, of their own, you know, normal, steady worlds, which I thought was a great way to display that, and something that you just, I don't see very often in films, which I thought this was a very bold concept of really starring those sort of shots.
Which is sort of fascinating because, as in still photography, you would call that diagonal composition. And that's exceptionally popular at the moment.
Oh. Well, a cool crossover then. I think what Scott's saying, I actually felt like I got a very different message out of this. Like it didn't reaffirm the fact that there are doubts about the unknown or the doubts about about religion. To me, it came across as much more, and maybe that's just because very early on I sided with one of the characters and was sort of, you know, kind of, you know, pulling for that character the entire time. And to me, I saw it as a movie about, you know, the defense of what's right, even when you're being, even when that means that you have to be, you know, a mean person. And I think it really does, you know, raise some interesting questions about, you know, what's the right way to teach people to do stuff? Should you be their friends? You know, should you be the sort of, you know, the tyrant who has your best interests in mind? I thought it really, you know, broached that concept very well and did a good job saying it. And also, I think it did a good job of doing this sort of a switch of, like, the character I think that you want to really like, which is definitely the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, and the character that you don't want to like, which is the Meryl Streep character playing this really mean nun-headmistress. You know, it plays on this concept that, you know, it might be that, you know, the person who, you know, seems the nicest on the front is actually the person who, you know, deep down and behind is, you know, really quite sinister, and the person who seems incredibly mean and on the, you know, and on the outside is actually, you know, the person who's the nicest and most caring on the inside. And the last moment of this film is like the first moment you see Meryl Streep's character really break down under all this stress, and it's a very moving moment for me. Something that I will definitely remember for quite a while. So again, I could not get enough of this film. Great pick, and my number three pick of the year. So moving on to the illustrious number two spot, which, you know, this was actually, the one and two were a very hard thing for me to decide, but my number two end up being Andrew Stanton's and Ben Burtt's WALL-E. And we have talked this one to death. I just want to add on that, I don't know, this is a film I think should be up for Best Picture and is not going to be, because I feel like the Academy Awards, which are, you know, like it or not, the standard of how we measure, you know, great movies in America, with, you know, stuff like the, you know, the People's Choice Awards really getting ignored by the critical community. I feel because the Oscars have this animated film category, WALL-E gets pigeonholed and is not going to compete for that top slot, which I think it stinking should, because it is a great film and way better than a lot of the other, you know, non-animated films this year.
It's not the anti-revolutionary road, unfortunately.
But what are you guys' thoughts on this, on the sort of the concept of the animated films category for Best Picture, or for the Academy Awards?
It's interesting, because at some point, on some level, it can give films a shot that wouldn't normally have it, for a very recognizable, very high publicity spot, you know, the best.
Sure. Like I would say Shrek, you know, winning a Best Animated Film category is... Shrek is not a great movie, not an Academy Award-winning movie, but it gives it the chance to get some recognition as being the best in its field.
Right, yes. But the problem then is that movies that should get so much more than that are relegated to just being called, you know, Best Animated Film, and since they've got that recognition, maybe the Academy decides that they've got the recognition, and therefore... Don't deserve consideration for Best Picture overall. And I really don't know what the answer to that is, other than maybe they should just give it both.
That's a good question. Yeah. Well, it's people aren't required on... So the way the Academy works is people get these ballots, and they put on whatever they want, whatever film they want, into these categories. I think with very little stipulation about how to do it. And I know a lot of the Pixar members who are a member of the Academy, they put Pixar movies for Best Picture all the time. But because there's that logical slot there, that a lot of the Academy members just, you know, take the animated film and toss it aside. And I almost to some degree now, and maybe just because I liked WALL-E so much and I feel like it's going to get cheated out of a slot it really deserves, or a nomination it really deserves, I feel almost like it's a defensive move by filmmakers to keep themselves sort of guarded from some of these really spectacular animated films.
I think it probably does provide that sort of insulation, well, ostensibly also providing the opportunity of recognizing these films that otherwise would be ignored to some extent.
Sure.
So like everything the Academy does, it's a good idea that isn't executed very well.
Right. And I will say, like, for as much as I loved WALL-E, like, I definitely had issues with it. I wish they could have kept to the sort of silent film aspect of the beginning of this movie and driven that all the way to the end, and sort of had the guts to make this a pseudo silent film. And once they get onto the ship in the end, and you introduce the human characters, like, I feel like a lot of like the portrayal of the human characters falls really flat in many cases. I feel like the driving point of WALL-E, which is really this love story between these two quirky characters, the two quirky robots, gets watered down, I think, by another message, which is, you know, trying to get the humans back to Earth. And while I understand that that plays a big part into this the really a commentary on waste that WALL-E is, I really wish they could have been a bit braver and been like, let's make this, you know, no human voices at all and all completely synthetic, you know, Ben Burtt animated voices, which I think originally was one of the concepts, but I think it got lost, obviously, down the way with the necessities of telling this human story.
The first 40 minutes of WALL-E are so divine that I am permitted and justified in saying it has no flaws whatsoever.
I agree. There's very little that I don't like in the first half of this movie. It's magical, and it's what Pixar does well, which is continue to surpass its own excellence, which is a huge thing.
And I mean, you see in WALL-E the fact that the people who made that film really know cinema. I mean, you could create an entire page of films that it sort of lovingly alludes to.
Oh, sure, sure. You
know,
yeah.
Even in just the subtlest little ways, a camera angle here, a sound effect there, you know, an art value somewhere.
Go ahead.
Is a salute to cinema as much as it is a salute to individuality and discovery.
Yeah, and I totally agree. There's so much love for the medium put into this film that it's, I feel that's, I mean, it's, and yet it's so happy and so light, and it can still affect you in that way. And that's something I don't know how Pixar manages to do that, to really drive home these huge concepts. Actually, that's one thing I'd like to talk to you guys about is what is your feeling on the sort of political message that WALL-E puts out, which is of, you know, environmentalism, of waste. Do you feel it's successful?
Well, you know, it does a better job than certain films by certain former vice presidents.
By certain Nobel laureates.
certain people have been recognized by organizations in Norway and Sweden. But, you know, I think at its base level, you know, if you listen to the lyrics in the Oscar-eligible song in the end of WALL-E, you know, it's about, like, you know, we'll all be happy together if we work together and don't screw up the planet. And it's true. So, you know, regardless of your political position, the base message of WALL-E is one that everyone can agree on. And the fact that sort of things get so politically colored nowadays when somebody comes out and says something, I think, is sort of doing WALL-E a disadvantage. Because I don't think WALL-E is very overtly political. I mean, it makes a couple, you know, very noticeable political allusions, like Stain the Course,
or even so the Big and Large being very much like a Walmart or something,
right, or there being sort of a good-natured cowboy boot wearing Southern president of Big and Large,
right.
But at the end of the day, are those pointed or specific enough to really be like barbs into any particular person, or are they just reminders of, you know, hey, we're not just a kiddie film, like my hairdresser called it when I said that I liked it. You know, this is a film for everyone, about everyone and anyone, you know.
It
very much is a film about individuality, but it reminds us that, you know, nobody here on the planet really is just an individual. We're all in this together.
Yeah, totally. Sean, thoughts?
My thoughts on it was, it seemed like, I mean, the backdrop of the environmental statements and the statements about conservation were so huge and obvious within it that it seemed like the more pointed and more, striking statement was one on consumerism and disconnectedness.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
That we see with the people in the spaceship waiting to return to Earth. Everyone is in their own little world. Mm-hmm. You know, the absolute apex of the digital revolution is to get everybody online and all connected that way, and well, sort of like we're doing here,
right,
and not in real life. And so, I think that's maybe the more stark message that they show, and how that will blind us to the real problems that are out there.
I think that's great. Yeah, that's I mean, you're right. The big obvious ones really are like the waste and environmental message. But that's something that, you know, I think I understood, but I really hadn't considered in a way. I think that's a great thing to pull out of this, that there really is a ton of commentary about sort of, you know, of just not being aware of what's going around you. And like, you know, like the moment, you know, like Wally bumps into one of the characters and like, you know, they just, you know, look out and see the stars and are suddenly, you know, amazed by this beauty and amazing stuff around them. You know, it's really easy, I think, for us, especially in this, you know, kind of computer digital age, to sort of forget about, you know, like, you know, outside our window is, you know, beautiful skies and trees and great stuff that needs to be taken care of too.
Yeah. The other thing that I found really interesting, and I actually had a discussion on this after walking out of the movie theater, was their portrayal of people in it. Every single person was overweight. Every single person was not just overweight, but every single person was obese.
Right, right.
Now, granted, you could take some of that as, well, they've been in space for this long, so their bones aren't up to that. But even so, that doesn't account for the actual body mass there.
Right.
And we were noting that more than any other group, at least in America, the obese and the overweight, it's okay to discriminate against them. It's okay to make fun of them. It's okay for all of this stuff.
Well, that's a good point.
And maybe maybe we ought to rethink that.
So did you feel that Wally was going along those same lines of sort of treating obese people in a negative light?
I'm not quite sure, because it was actually pretty neutral on that.
I agree, obviously.
you got the idea that this was not a good thing because people were trapped in this sort of feedback mm-hmm. of get everything you want now, and you don't ever have to do anything, which generally leads to that.
Sure.
But, you know, there's so many other ways, and you know, most people that are obese, it's certainly not a choice that they've made, and
sure.
would probably rather not be.
Sure, right.
And usually it's more a combination of many, many factors that build up
right.
over time.
Yeah, I think those are all again great points that you wouldn't, I think, at least I had not considered from this movie, that it does I guess in some ways paint the concept of obesity right next to sort of complacency, and in that way is critical in a very American accepted way of being critical of obese people, because it's, you know, you're obese because you choose to be obese, which is, I mean, you could almost, you know, apply that to so many other issues we have in America, you know, like homosexuality, where there's this big, you know, this big debate and question over, like, are you that way because of other factors, or that way because you choose to be that way? And there's definitely a huge sense that for obesity, it's, you know,
and
you're obese because it's your own fault, right?
Yeah, there's at least as much scientific evidence to link obesity with heredity as
sure.
there is, you know, homosexuality or any host of other things.
I would say probably more so from my own personal studies of psychology and physiology. There, I think there's way more evidence to link obesity to heredity.
And yet, it's okay to bash on those people because
sure.
it's their own fault,
right?
And you know, that's just I don't know. It's interesting, I think, that we do that as a culture and as a society. Sort of overlook this, and to even sort of draw that point just a little bit further before we move on is very interesting, because seems like I heard statistics that maybe even a majority of people in America are technically overweight.
I think I've heard that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, what gives on that?
It's definitely I'm sure to be a hot button issue,
we've convinced the majority to be ashamed of themselves so much that they don't even think it's inappropriate
right.
to rag on that sort of thing.
Sure, yeah, definitely an interesting point. Cool stuff. Deep grabs for social commentary from Sean. Great stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons that the movie is so great, because it draws out those sorts of conversations.
Yeah. Most definitely. Well, I think that's. I'm sure we could probably spend hours and hours talking about WALL-E, but let's
and
see.
It probably should
in many ways, but let's. We'll have to, you know, as we say in Microsoft, take that conversation offline and move on to the last movie on my list, the number one, and what I think is hands down the best movie of the year, movie I most enjoyed this year, and you probably know what this movie is going to be, but it's Chris Nolan's.
It's the one you haven't mentioned yet.
It's Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight.
You want to know how I got these scars? My father was a drinker and a fiend. And one night, he goes off crazier than usual. Mommy gets the kitchen knife to defend herself. He doesn't like that. Not one bit. So, me watching, he takes the knife to her, laughing while he does it. He turns to me and he says, "Why so serious?" He comes at me with the knife. "Why so serious?" He sticks the blade in my mouth. "Let's put a smile on that face." And... why so serious?
Absolutely. I saw it in a digital 4K theater, which is a really nice digital theater, great resolution. It was not IMAX, unfortunately, but still a wonderful presentation, and I was transfixed by this movie. Like, there's a very, like, I can remember few moments in my life of being completely transfixed by a movie, and, like, I remember the first time I saw Apollo 13, when I was young, and I wasn't really aware of what the story of Apollo 13 was, and the entire, like, I remember I got, like, this big tub of popcorn to see Apollo 13, and, you know, I started eating it, and then the movie started going, and then by the end of the movie, there was a full tub of popcorn. I had not eaten one thing of popcorn because I was so transfixed by the events of this movie, and The Dark Knight, you know, obviously, you know, I didn't feel quite as much tension or fear as I did watching Apollo 13 when I was young, but same level of transfixion where I just could not take my eyes off this movie and just felt, I felt it was so easy to sort of let myself go and sort of be absorbed into the environment of the movie and the concept of the movie and really let it sort of, you know, wash over me in the theaters. And movies that can do that, I mean, it's just, there's so few of them out there, and this is definitely one of them. I heard one commentator talking about this, and they said, you know, when they left this movie, they felt electrified. They felt, you know, like there's this energy in them. And when I felt the same thing walking out of this movie, I had about a 30-minute drive home, and the entire way I was just like, you know, giddy and excited and electrified. And this movie defines the reason why I love doing commentary on movies, why I love entertainment. This is one of those movies that makes me, you know, glad to be in that world and keeps me continually going in it. It's I could not, you know, put enough superlatives and praise on this movie. Any closing thoughts from you, Scott, about The Dark Knight?
It very single-handedly will transport you to another place, and it will strike you as very believable. And you'll be very interested in the questions the movie raises. Well, that makes it sound terrible, doesn't it?
let me put it this way. I've always been a fan of Batman.
Right.
Always. Since as early as I could remember. And the thing is, though, the Joker was a fun villain, but I never thought him the best villain.
I agree.
Back in my junior high days, maybe y'all remember this. This was probably even elementary school for me. Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah, with Mark Hamill doing the voice of the Joker.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely phenomenal animated
show. Totally agree.
One of the best ever. And perhaps even one of the best ever portrayals of Batman.
Oh, I think it's, to me, it's the standard I base all of the Batmans on, by far.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So, the Batman movies were, from the, 89 Batman
right,
to...
The Tim Burton Batmans, right?
Yeah, Tim Burton.
To the crazy... Batman Forevers and
they were constant and increasing disappointments.
Exactly.
What, Batman, you weren't a huge fan of Mr. Freeze?
Okay, everybody, chill.
Yeah, seriously. actually, DC has been doing some really nice direct-to-video animated features. With its characters. I highly recommend picking up any of those. They're really
I saw good. Recently a Superman versus Doomsday, which is...
Superman Doomsday. Excellent
which
film.
Of course, the classic comic where Superman is killed.
Right.
I remember that being a huge event. I had a friend who was huge in the comic books.
And they strung it out for a year or more. Ridiculous. This really condenses the return aspect. That's kind of fine to me, because the movie is just, it's fantastic because it really drills down into some of the characters that have in other Superman movies mostly been backdrops, like sure. Lois Lane.
Oh yeah.
Gets nearly a starring role in the film. Good movie.
Is it with the same voice acting characters as were in the animated Superman series?
I believe so. And it's the same style. Very stark, angular lines.
Right.
Fantastic style. Right. Great stuff. But anyway, so we get Batman Begins, and I'm really blown away with what they've done. They've really taken Batman back to what it should be, which is a story that resonates, because Batman, his superpower is that he's super rich. Other than that, he's got nothing that the rest of us don't have, except maybe some highly advanced martial arts
skills, right.
So it's really about the character and about how he deals with all of these things, like you said, like justice and other ideas. But what The Dark Knight did that no other Batman incarnation I've seen before do was to truly bring the Joker villain into something that was transcendent.
Absolutely,
of what I thought that character was capable of.
Now, I think it's a great word for it too. It really, it's hard to see how, you know, anything or how any description of this character could be contained. It really is one of those. No one, I don't think, will ever come to matching the Joker on this level in comic books, in cartoons. Like, this is it. This is the pinnacle of the Joker character.
Here's why he is the best Batman villain in the history of Batman.
Right.
In Batman Begins, the remark is made that Batman cannot be a person. He cannot be a human. He must be an idea.
Right.
He has to become this force of legend.
Right.
That's what the Joker is. He is this opposing idea. He is so much more than the crazy man in clown makeup wielding a knife or two.
Right.
What he does is something to make everyone else stand up and watch. And I think one of the most surprising and startling entrances is when he comes into to the meeting of the gangsters
right.
and does the pencil trick.
The pencil trick.
The pencil trick.
Which, like, rarely do I see audiences move in unison, but in this movie, like, everyone, like, got that.
Everyone's like, oh!
It was tremendous. It, like, it made me feel like, you know, like, we, the audience, were all one part of one person, one being. Like, we all were just, like, nailing every single one of, like, the moments where they expected you to, you know, to shout or yell something, and everyone doing it at the exact same time. It was really
yeah.
an experience.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what makes it great. And now you've made me want to see it again.
Well, I just got it on Blu-ray and I've not seen it yet, but
the WB would like to remind you it's now available on Blu-ray and DVD at retailers everywhere.
But yeah,
I'm it's not a HD DVD.
I'm definitely just talking about it, like, you know, reliving, like, the excitement and hype that I have from seeing this movie. One last thing before we finish out this top movie recap is, let's talk about what they did with IMAX. Honestly, I think this is a tremendous trend, and hopefully will be something that we see more and more people doing, as it seems like IMAX is now transitioning from becoming this, you know, this museum piece to being a way to show, you know, popular films, and really, really just a different way of presenting movies. Chris Nolan, I think, had a tremendous idea to actually shoot a majority and, like, all the major action scenes in this huge, huge format of IMAX with the IMAX cameras, and I was blown away by those scenes. Like, I've never seen things that look so beautiful, and the great thing is, it wasn't just, you know, like, a movie about Mount Everest or about, like, the fires of Kuwait or about beavers. It was, you know, a movie that, you know, I could actually enjoy seeing with my friends and not just with, you know, like, my science buddies.
So you're saying you have something against ancient sea monsters?
I love IMAX films. Actually, you know, mentioning Fires of Kuwait was, you know, a stunningly beautiful thing to watch. But, you know, here's this great movie also presented in, like, the most resolution that a great movie has ever been presented in. Do you guys think this is going to be a trend? What were your thoughts on the use of IMAX in it, if you saw it in IMAX?
Well, I mean, it's nothing new to blow up prints to IMAX size and slap them in IMAX
sure.
theaters. The distributor makes, you know, 300% that way.
Because I recall seeing, I don't remember which Lord of the Rings movie it was, but I saw one of those in an IMAX theater. It was a little bit disappointing, too, because you'd sort of see the bleeding edges of the film because the screen was so huge and the projection on it didn't cover the thing.
Right. And it's to me, like, watching The Dark Knight in IMAX was not only a great thing, but also, like, a constantly kind of disappointing thing too, because, like, it starts out in this beautiful, full, you know, field of view encompassing IMAX, and then suddenly it cuts to the, you know, the expanded print version of it, and, like, when it goes to that, you're just like, aww. And, like, you spend, like, every minute of those, like, scenes. And this was the second time I'd seen it, so I wasn't watching it just to, you know, grab the story, but, you know, I was watching it to get the subtleties. And every time one of those scenes came on, I was like, man, when's the next IMAX scene? When is that coming? And every time I come back, it would, you know, it just, you know, again, you know, excite me. And I just, you had, you know, these beautiful action scenes shot in this super crisp, clear IMAX definition.
Was
it's a great concept.
Screening them from shooting the whole film like that.
I only imagine it's either a cost or a technical thing. I mean, I'm sure these IMAX cameras are not easy to shoot on because the film is so stinking huge that it must be really hard to haul that film around to shoot long scenes on this. Scott, you know far more technical stuff about movie cameras than I do, so maybe you can speak to this.
Well, I mean, typically you would expect developing costs, shooting costs, film costs, camera rental, prints, that sort of stuff. Hopefully not to take up more than about 10% of the budget of a film. But, I mean, on a big action picture that costs, you know, $300 million, that's a lot of money. If anything, shooting IMAX is easily twice that expensive, if not considerably more expensive. Because, you know, You need, if you do a digital intermediate, you need a very specialized house that will scan that for you.
But I mean,
you would need specialized editing machines. You can't just use a normal Moviola if you want to edit it. Traditionally speaking, traditional, you know, photochemical finish.
But I mean, there's so many of like these, like, you know, out there, like documentary producers who produce, you know, these, you know, these 45 minute to an hour long, you know, features in IMAX. And you can bet these people probably not have huge budgets, not the kind of budgets that The Dark Knight had. So, I mean, I really wonder why they felt they could not shoot this entire thing in IMAX.
Because Warner Brothers was paying for it, and they know exactly how much money they were planning on getting and realized that every additional dollar they spent shooting more of an IMAX was money they wouldn't be getting.
Right, right.
I mean, of course, The Dark Knight is, you know, one of the most financially successful films of all time. Of course, they could have shot the whole thing in IMAX and had tons of profit left over.
Sure.
But, you know, if you went up to Warner Brothers and said, hey, you could make this movie really cool if you would just be willing to walk away from, you know, another $25, $30 million, they would say that's great, but it's cool enough the way it is.
Yeah.
And the fact that Chris Nolan was able to wrangle...
That's a good point.
Wrangle the commitment to IMAX for the sequences he did was pretty spectacular, and he's to be given great accolades for using what's a really spectacular technique to do something that everyone will agree was really spectacular and makes a normal film just blown up into an IMAX format really look sort of childish.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, let me say this, though. As movie struggles to stay in the theaters and out of people's homes as its primary viewing place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we get more services like Netflix or just direct download stuff. I think that 3D is the wrong place to look. You know, I think that the IMAX format is the correct way to go.
I think that's a good discussion. We can actually, we probably shouldn't have it now just because we're pretty over budget on time, but maybe something we can have later.
Well,
but
let me suggest this. Why don't we save our games discussion for next week? Split it up into two.
Yep, I think
because we're about probably as long as we want to get here on just movies.
I think so, and. With that that being said, let's go ahead and take this one down, boil it down. Before we finish up this first podcast, one thing I want to do is let us go around and mention our honorable mentions, the stuff that we really liked but didn't quite make it onto our top 10 list. I'll go ahead and start off with that. Some of my movies I really, really enjoyed were on my good list, and were some of them even vying for that top 10 or that number 10 spot. Were Mrs. Pettigrew Lives for a Day. I think a great movie. I think that got overlooked by a lot of people. A really fun movie, a really cool take on the sort of like 1950s style of movie and style of filmmaking. Absolutely fun movie. You should see it if you get the chance. Next, Rock and Rolla, which was the new Guy Ritchie film. It wasn't great, but I thought promised a good return to form and sort of the concept of the sort of snatch style of gangster films or the lock stock style of gangster films. It promises to be cool because I'm not sure like how confirmed this is, but like the end of Rock and Rolla, there in the credit roll sequence, it says, you know, look forward to, you know, the real Rock and Rolla, which I guess is supposed to be the sequel to this, and I hope wasn't like an inside joke that I just didn't miss, but I'm really looking forward to see what Guy Ritchie does with that.
Well, of course, he is directing the British-produced Sherlock Holmes with Robert Downey Jr. in London.
Right. And Sacha Baron Cohen, right?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Yeah, great to see Guy Ritchie back on form after a long hiatus from Snatch, and now that he has shed himself of a certain Madonna that is... I think done.
Not to be mentioned.
Done great things for him. Changeling, a Clint Eastwood film with Angelina Jolie, also another spectacular film. A little boring, I think, and maybe to its detriment, which is why I did not make my top 10 list. But contrasted by some really thought provoking and moving scenes, and some of the most horrific stuff I have seen in a movie. Like not gory, but just horrifying, especially, and again, this is one of those movies I would say don't watch if you can't stand watching bad things happen to little children, but a good movie, a great thought-provoking movie, I think reasonable in Clint Eastwood's fare. Flash of Genius, one that I think sort of kind of got forgotten a while. This great little story about this guy who invents the intermittent windshield wiper. Really fun story. Probably not the greatest acting performances, but still very heartwarming and very very family-friendly, too. So I would definitely recommend this one out. Cloverfield, which is one I think we've all forgotten about, which I thought
We haven't forgotten.
I thought was, in retrospect, was a really, really fun movie. Like sure, it was kind of gimmicky, and it had been done before with Blair Witch, but, you know, props to J.J. Abrams for really presenting a different turn on the Godzilla movie. Like it was basically, you know, you're watching Godzilla movie from one of those, like, little teeny characters that you see scampering around on the ground, which I thought was a cool concept, at least, and a reasonably cool execution. So, my last two on this list, The Bank Job with Jason Statham, a really fun movie. I think a little too dark in its end to its detriment, but a fun movie to check out. A neat little sort of caper movie that's actually based on a true story. And lastly, of course, one I think that was vying for that top 10 spot was Wanted, which we already talked about. Just a great escapist film. Scott, do you have any honorable mentions you'd like to call out?
I would like to shout out to Valkyrie. I know everybody skipped out on it because it's Tom Cruise and he's Tom Cruise crazy. but it's actually really not bad. It's interesting sort of as a historical drama for the first half and then as a thriller for the second half. I mean, as is the case with any historical motion picture like Apollo 13 or something like that, you sort of know what is going to happen at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thanks to having paid any attention in ninth grade history. But it still succeeds in being really fascinating about the how and the where and the why in between. And Tom Cruise actually, he actually does good. And, you know, apart from his appalling German at the very beginning of the film, which I can overlook, having appalling German myself, it's not really that much of a problem. And in the same sort of line of films, which are not spectacular but are good and are worth respecting for some reason or another, Burn After Reading, the Coen brothers. Maybe I just have a place for dark comedies in which everyone dies. It's like an In Bruges with all the humanity removed and stupidity injected, and the location moved slightly to the tri-state area. You know, you have to be somebody who's willing to swallow a cynical movie without being too bitter yourself about it. But if you can do that, you'll enjoy it.
Great. Any others you want to mention? Or
I like out there, but unless Scott's got something else.
No, knock yourself out.
Yeah, go for it, Sean. What are some of your honorable mentions?
There's a lot of love for Pixar out there, but Disney did some nice stuff, I have to say, with Bolt.
I've heard that, yeah.
I went to go see this with my family and my younger cousins, so it's definitely well within the kids movie fare, but the entire movie is just so darned cute that you can't not like it. And the interesting thing, though, is that while they're doing 3D with it, it's very subtle. You know, my mom came out of there saying, "Where was the 3D?" And she'd had the glasses on all the time, just hadn't really picked it up.
Right.
I noticed it, but again, it was a very subtle thing.
Right.
So props to them for taking the latest gimmick and doing it subtly rather than over the top. And catering towards it.
Yeah, I saw Bolt and really enjoyed it. I really enjoy any movie that has a computer-animated rodent in it of some sort. I could watch the Ice Age trailers indefinitely.
Yes,
but it really was very cute and sort of enjoyable. And I agree, absolutely worth seeing in 3D. It was subtle. It was not Beowulf.
Yeah. Oh.
There were no swords.
Swords
spears
pointed at your eye.
Yeah. Oh. Rhino, the hamster, was just fully awesome, to use his own turn of phrase.
So is this something you guys would recommend even without the sort of 3D effect applied to it?
Oh yeah. I mean, the 3D effect was fairly subtle, so okay. you'd fully enjoy the movie without it. But yeah, a fun film. It wasn't tremendously deep. That's probably about the only drawback that I could give it.
Sure.
That kind of hates on cats a little bit.
some funny commentary off to the side, which you only get if you're into showbiz about network television, and also about Miley Cyrus if you watch for
yes.
it in the first act of the film.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Recommended.
Well, great.
Now, I do have to say one thing. I'm a little bit disappointed at Disney's willingness to let this go completely confused with a fully Pixar picture. Because I'm sure that there were a number of people confused. This is, in fact, Disney Animation Studios, albeit a lot of Pixar people were involved.
Right. Which I heard, I don't quite remember, that one of the big Pixar bigwigs was moving over to head up the Disney Animation Studios, right?
Could be John Lasseter.
John Lasseter, exactly, right.
Yeah. So maybe so. Hopefully Pixar continues its stellar record. And because obviously John Lasseter is doing nice things for Disney. The two companies are so close that it's, you know, probably a small move unless they have another falling out.
Though definitely, you know, some really bad Disney Animation Studios movies have been out already. Like the Chicken Little movie that came out, I heard was just atrocious. And they had the Meet the Robinsons movie that was out a little recently, which I heard was also very lackluster. So it's good to see that there's some change going around the Disney studios, that we might actually have two great animation studios to look forward to, as I do not consider DreamWorks SKG a great animation studio. But I've been told Kung Fu Panda was actually fun, so
yes, so I'm not harping on that. Actually, my friend Megan, who is in the same program that Lars is in, got to work with a bunch of people from DreamWorks who had worked on Kung Fu Panda.
Oh,
had
cool.
a tremendous experience with them. So they're a little hit and miss is really their problem.
I would
they
say more miss than hit, but I'll agree that
well,
I've enjoyed
I
some
a
of
little
theirs.
Hit and miss.
So they're miss and hit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Perhaps it's the proper order.
Right. So I think perhaps we can look forward to some better things from them in the future, though.
That's good.
Which is always encouraging as the medium develops.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have any, Scott or Sean, any other movies you want to mention out as great movies to go see but not quite top 10 worthy? Or have we just about exhausted that bucket?
I think we've got quite the Netflix queue for any of our, our regular visitors at dailymonotony.com, all three or four of them.
Great.
Right.
Well, then I think we're going to go ahead and wrap that up. Thanks, everyone who's listening, for coming and joining us on our inaugural and probably somewhat shaky in retrospect podcast. We hope we've excited you about some movies and that you'll go out and see some of these movies while they're still in theaters, and Netflix the ones that you can't.
Audacity will fix the rough spots that we've got.
Exactly. The magic of editing will always improve what we've got. So thanks again for joining us, and as always, check out dailymonotony.com for reviews of movies and games, and be sure to keep track of what we're watching. We actually have those up on the side. You can see what we're watching in TV and movies, what we're playing in games, what we enjoy as far as books. Keep track of our own personal opinions on in the sea of entertainment commentary as we provide a little bit more monotony in your life. So thanks for joining.
And good night.
And good night, indeed.
Dos vidania, Dr. Jones.